These are the voices of Rotary.
The voices that tell our stories.
The voices that share our why.
The voices that make our lives matter.
The voices that relieve suffering and anguish.
These are the voices of Rotary that change lives.
Take a listen.
These are stories of service above self. Rotary's highest honor recognizes individuals who personify Rotary's motto, service above self, by volunteering their time and talents in exceptional service to others. It is awarded annually by Rotary International based on nominations from district governors. Only a maximum of 150 nominations worldwide are considered, no more than one per district, and even fewer are actually selected each year. Since Rotary is recognized worldwide as a service organization, active in local and international communities, how individuals dedicated to service above self are making a difference in people's lives, are uplifting stories of interest, and an inspiration to others. This is part of a series bringing you stories about people of action who put service above self to make a difference. Frances Dixon was recognized with this very special Rotary Award as a true agent of change at the Virtual District Celebration in September 2020. Frances, welcome to the Voices of Rotary, where we share stories of service with fellow Rotarians and members of the community.
Thank you. Thank you, Emily.
As founder of Adopt a Village in Guatemala, you have dedicated the last three decades to bringing education and literacy to underserved Maya communities in Guatemala's remote Western Highlands. Please tell us how you found these communities in need, what compelled you to tackle a nearly impossible task, and how you went about to make a difference.
You know, Emily, when I first went to Guatemala, it wasn't with all this in mind. What happened transpired over a period of time. I went to Guatemala with the idea that it was another country that I wanted to visit. I'd been basically a world traveler, you might say, since I got out of school. Guatemala came up on the list. But when I arrived in Guatemala, there was something profoundly different for me than all the other places I'd ever visited. There was something that went way beyond poverty. And so it became a learning experience for me, an awareness experience, and something that would ultimately completely change my life. My first trip was a trip on what they traditionally call a chicken bus, and it was a chicken bus, as all the passengers, with the exception of myself, were indigenous people, Mayan people. And indeed, there was a little girl, she'd be about 7-8 years old, with a chicken on her lap, sitting across the aisle from me. Now, I was on my way to Tikal on this horrific, horrendous 17-hour bus trip over a dirt road that gave you a 1 30-minute stop within those 17 hours to do whatever you're going to do, eat, get some water, etc. So I spent the next 17 hours on this bus with these indigenous people. This was my first experience. And that was my first impression. And of course, she was delightful, beautiful, and as a typical tourist, you might say, I addressed her father and said, "May I take a picture of your daughter?" And he was fine with that. At that point, everybody on that bus knew I had a camera. And I didn't realize the significance of that until we got further into the trip. We drove and drove and drove. And after many hours, the father crossed the aisle and touched my shoulder. So I gathered what he was saying. He was pointing to my camera. So I figured, well, he allowed me to take a picture of his daughter, then, you know, maybe he wanted a picture. And I said, sure, what of? And he pointed through the window and up on a hill. And so I took a look, and up there I saw a long line of armed soldiers And I thought, what does he mean? What is he looking for? But he made it evident that he wanted me to take a picture of one of the soldiers with a gun. Nonetheless, I was there to please him, and I said, sure. So I kind of pushed my part of my body out the window that I'd lowered down and took the photo. And as I sat back in my seat, everybody on that bus cheered. And it didn't strike me at the moment. It took quite a while for that to sink in, days, maybe weeks, maybe months, to understand the significance of it as I became more self-educated on what was really happening in this war, because I'd arrived in the midst of a civil war, and it was not just any old civil war. This was a war of genocide. It was a war of genocide against Guatemala's indigenous people. And I can say that it was such a war because when it finally ended 30 years in its length, the United Nations declared it as a war of genocide.
And in 1978, a series of massacres began that ultimately by 1982 was a genocide. 626 villages were destroyed.
What was your impression of the indigenous Guatemalan people, the Maya? Clearly, there was something very special about them for you to eventually spend so much time with them.
There's two or three things that come to my mind when you ask me that question. First of all, I found them to be reticent, kind of maybe you might say a little withdrawn. However, I did notice that if you smiled, you got a smile back three times as big as the one you gave them. And the other thing I came to notice, which really bothered me tremendously, was this feeling of fear, the feeling that there was just something terribly wrong, which there was. And that was all wrapped up in the fact that in those days when I was traveling there, there were still army massacres going on in the villages that I had traveled through. So those were two things that really impacted me. The fact that the Mayan people were warm and welcoming, but also that they lived in dreadful fear.
But the massacre is what opens up a wave of violence that seems endless, because the people who survive the massacres can't stay, and so they flee. They flee up into the mountains. What do you go to the mountains with? What do you have on you right now? Go. Imagine yourself living in flight from an army that's trying to hunt you down for 2 to 4 years, because those are the conditions that people lived in up in the mountains after the massacres all over Guatemala. The survivors then have to go on and be hunted by the army.
After your initial introduction to the Maya people and to that remote area, how did you come to found Adopt a Village in Guatemala, the nonprofit organization that you've headed for so long? How did that get started?
I discovered the incredible beauty of this country. And of all the many countries I probably traveled in, close to 70 countries in the world, this to me was profoundly beautiful. And I arrived in one village and stopped the jeep, got out of the jeep, and just looked and looked and looked at the mountains that surrounded the whole area. And it actually occurred to me that I thought, wow, I wonder what it would be like to live here. And I thought, well, you know, that's kind of like a crazy idea. But that crazy idea stayed with me. And then I took a step back and I thought, you know, if such a thing happened, how could I justify to myself living in such a beautiful place, but living with people in such poverty, under such circumstances? And I realized that I couldn't justify it. There was no justification, except perhaps one. And that was if I was willing to give back to these same people. And I made that decision. And I didn't know how that was going to go. I really didn't know what that meant at that particular time. I was owner and running a magazine publishing company in Florida. You know, I was in a career. I was working. I was busy. How could I do such a thing? But it wasn't too long, and I was knee-deep, and before I knew it, neck-deep, in doing exactly that, giving back. I started in the most simplistic way, just asking people for donations. Everything was needed. I mean, the poverty was so extreme. I mean, the kids were without shoes, running around in rags. There was no schools. There's no pencils, no paper, no nothing, absolutely nothing. You're starting from ground zero. So I didn't know anything about running or organizing or founding an international nonprofit organization. I jumped in cold and started asking for donations and loading up my suitcases on these trips full of like crayons and old clothes, used clothes and things like that. But it wasn't too long before I saw that we've got to move ahead here. We've got to start building some schools. We've got to start building some water systems. And that's when I walked away from my publishing company and jumped in with both feet.
The needs you noticed initially were pretty much across the board. Clothing, nutrition, water, schools, anything and everything. So how did you and your organization eventually focus on the educational aspects? How did that vision, that goal, emerge for you as the area of focus with the most impact?
The peace accords were signed in 1996, and I had been working in a small village for 7 years, and basically it was kind of like marking time for the end of that war, because I knew there were tens of thousands of refugees that had fled to Mexico, United States, Canada, more of them hidden in the mountains. And I knew that when the war ended, most of them would come back. And really, that's where my focus and my desire was to help the returning refugees. And when that day came, I set out with a couple of staff people close to the Mexican border where they were coming back, and began to meet with the village leaders. And all I saw was this unbelievable need. People had walked back from Mexico. The dad had a machete in his hand. The baby, the mother had a baby on her back and a couple in holding onto her hands. They had a few clothes. They had a little bag of corn seed so that they could begin planting new crops of food, and maybe one or two sheets of plastic, flimsy plastic. And they would pitch that as kind of a roof to keep the rain off when they slept on the ground at night. So all I could think was, well, let's see now, they need food, they need water, that kind of thing. No, they told me over and over again, we want education for our children. And they were willing to sacrifice everything. Any offers of food, of water, clean water, the whole thing. No, they wanted education. Well, I mean, I have to tell you, I was kind of stunned. But it was so important to them. But, you know, looking back, I think these were parents, illiterate parents, who'd never, ever had an opportunity for children, for their education. They'd never had an opportunity for education. And they wanted more for their children. They'd been through this horrific war. They had survived. But this go around, this next generation, they had a vision. And the vision was education for their children. And that was the one factor that made me decide that, hey, that's what it's going to be.
After 3 decades, your organization now provides several educational programs to Maya children in that remote area. Please describe these programs and tell us your vision, your end goal for them.
Just touching back a little bit onto those, into those years just after the war, because the needs were so tremendous, the organization Adopt a Village in Guatemala focused basically on post-construction war needs, which were building schools, and we built many schools, and water systems, and roads, and homes, and we did that. Children eventually got into the primary schools, and then they began to graduate from the sixth grade. And then the next question was, well, now what do they do? And parents came to me and said, you know, would we build middle schools? And I kind of took a look at that and I thought, gosh, here in Guatemala, the government has a system that kids only go to school in the morning. And then a school would just sit for the rest of the day. So I said, well, you know, you've got a kind of a nice school here. Could you consider putting middle school-aged kids into classes in the afternoon? And as it happened, that came about across the board, and it's still going on today. Primary schools in the morning and the middle school is in the afternoon. So that's appeared on the surface to be the way to go. But then I started thinking, wow, the years are flying by here. What are they going to do about high school? Because if they get through middle school, really, it's not going to give them any education to get any better job than swinging a machete in these coffee farms. They're going to need a high school. And there was nothing, absolutely nothing. And that was a big, major turning point for Adopt a Village in Guatemala. It meant a total departure from what we'd been doing with the post-war construction idea. We were moving along here. We were moving now into the future. And it was going to require some heavy-duty funding. It was going to require a whole new logistical plan. And it was going to require purchasing property and getting into some major construction, school construction. So as I say, that was a turning point. And that's when we began to move solidly into the whole concept of education for the indigenous people, indigenous children in this region.
Looking back at these three decades of service, what motivates you right now and keeps you going?
I think what motivates me, as you say, today is what motivated me 30 years ago. It hasn't changed. And I say it hasn't changed for the reason that there's been very little change in my eyes on what is going on with the conditions and the situation of the indigenous people of Guatemala. They're still discriminated against. They're still set apart from opportunities for employment, for education, for any way to dig out from this extreme poverty in which they still live. And if you check out some of the statistics, you'll find that there are people there who are more poor. They're poorer than they were before the war. So I ask myself, you know, what motivated me back then? It's what motivated me today. There's extreme injustice in that country. There's extreme injustice against the descendants of an ancient and noble civilization. Where's the systemic change? I don't see any. And insofar as education, the entire educational system is set up to fail indigenous children. The indigenous population, where we are, live in remote mountains. Emily, you've been there with me, and you know of what I'm speaking. Villages that are set back in places where there's hardly roads to get to them. And the situation with teachers, sometimes they might show up, more often they don't. There's no supplies in the schools, there's no books. It's hard for us here to imagine a school without books. And so life has changed very little. And so you ask me, what motivates me today? And I say again, it's what motivated me 30 years ago. And that is, I think, the drive I have to look for a change, to be an agent of change. For instance, we are agents of change. We have established education for kids from age 4 on up to 20 across the board. We are making changes, and it's slow. One could say it's small, but to see the success of what is happening, that's a part of motivation, I think, that would drive anybody further on into this challenge.
Adopt a Village in Guatemala just celebrated 30 years of service, a long time for a nonprofit organization to stay active and relevant and continue to make a difference in this impoverished area. Looking back at these 3 decades of service to Maya children and families, what are your hopes for them in the next decade and beyond?
What I am seeing is much has been established. The infrastructure of our plans, our visions, our dreams is actually there. We have schools, they're built. We have teachers, some excellent teachers, and teachers that we've taken great pains to provide training to bring them to a point where they can give quality education to the kids, to encourage them to see the bigger picture, the real need of what a teacher is, that it's just not a teacher salary and you show up maybe when you feel like it, but to really dig in and be part of this change for future, for the future lives of these kids. And that's there. That's established. So what I am seeing, for instance, for the next decade, is that we build on that. And how do we build on that? Well, right off the bat, I would say one avenue is to bring in the mix, incorporate technology.
Hola, compañeras. Buenas tardes.
Buenas tardes.
¿Cómo están?
Bien. ¿Y tú?
Igual, todo bien. Gracias a Dios.
Technology in that area in education is virtually unknown. It almost does not exist. In the first place, you can't get an internet signal in those villages, so the schools don't have any internet. The Guatemalan government decrees that if a school, like a middle school, is going to have computers, it's up to the parents to purchase them. Well, the parents, for the most part, are subsistence farmers. And to be honest, they can't even feed their kids half the time. But no, they are responsible for buying computers for the kids in the school. So what that means is that there's a scramble to find old, used, maybe reconditioned computers that don't last any time at all. And there's no one to service them. No one to keep them going. Once they kind of like run out of steam, well, then they're just packed away in some storage area, and it's back to point one. So, to repeat, the technology is practically zero. So, what does that really mean for kids going into the future? We all know that the world has changed, and it's changing every single day, and if Indigenous kids can't have any ability or training or learning in the computer field, where does that leave them? I strongly believe that technology has got to be part and parcel of the training so that kids can move along in life and have a better future. So we have instituted that whole concept of technology, and particularly since COVID began. That actually has been a tremendous turning point in the style of education that we're giving, because we've had to go virtual just like everybody in the world has. But we've had some difficulties that in many places don't exist. For instance, go into a village, no internet. Go into a village, no electricity. How can you manage a virtual learning program under those conditions? We've had to innovate, we've had to scramble, we've had to pull out all stops. What does that mean? Okay, for instance, yes, the smartphone is your major tool for virtual learning. But how do you charge it if there's no electricity? Okay, so we take a look at that. What do you know out there? Solar chargers are there to be purchased. So we get solar chargers to the kids and they can charge up their phone. But then what? So we provide computer tablets. Of course, they need to be charged. Well, that's solved. We've got the solar charger. But what about an internet signal? Now, there you can get just stopped cold. Now, the interesting thing about that region, and it is very, very mountainous, internet towers have been built all throughout those mountains. And it's possible to get a signal if you're in the right place, close enough to the tower, you can get a signal. But that's iffy. And in fact, when we began our virtual program, these kids were out hiking through the mountains, virtually looking for a signal. However, just recently, we've been able to bring in internet boosters. We've taken them into the villages, we've tested them out. In every single case, 100% of cases, kids have been able to connect through that booster. This is revolutionary. This is not happening anywhere in Guatemala. This is first time. This is groundbreaking for our organization. And the fact that we have teachers who are willing and wanting to move into technology and use it for the benefits for the kids has been key in the success that we are experiencing right now. And you ask me about the next 10 years, Emily, I would say that we're going to see more and more and more of this, and we're going to have more families, parents, and kids excited, and they are. They're tremendously excited. Nobody else in the village has the system going that we do, and the news is spreading. And I think this is going to be paramount in seeing a change in education for the children that we are helping.
Next time on Voices of Rotary.
This is Emily Francona, and you've been listening to stories about people of action. Stay tuned for part two of Francis Dixon's experiences and actions in Guatemala.
There is so much need out there. Have you ever wondered how you can help? Join us for the journey at voicesofrotary.org.